You're up.
I'm up.
You're up.
All right. There you go. All right. Hi, I'm Steve Apps. I'm an alcoholic. I got a sobriety date of the 28th of July, 2014. I've got a home group, the Deal Men's in Melbourne, Australia. I've got a sponsor. He's got a sponsor. I talked to all those guys. They showed me how to get a spiritual awakening by reading a book and by going through the steps. And like it says in step 12, as a result of doing the steps, I get a spiritual awakening, and that's not how I came in. You know, my story is a lot like everyone else's story. I drank and I loved it, and I took drugs and I loved it, and I did that for a long time, and I had a lot of fun, and it slowly but surely got worse and worse, and I wasn't fun anymore. And my story is I've had lots of warnings and things come along the way. You know, I nearly died a couple of times. You know, my parents were called to come and see me in hospital because the docs thought I was going to pass that night. And, like, there was a lot of stuff that happened. I crashed cars. I've been arrested. I did, you know, a lot of stuff happened. And I could tell you a really long story about all the crap I did. But, you know, it's all the same crap that everyone else does. So, well, that's pretty true. And anyway, so, like, at the end, the very end, I went in and out of rehabs and I couldn't get sober even doing that. I saw doctors, I saw psychologists, I saw psychiatrists. I did all those things that we sort of do to try and find out what was wrong with me, or my parents were trying to find out what was wrong with me. And none of them worked. They might work for a little bit and it'd end up going back in, like my sponsor says, you know. You know, Brittany read the first page of More About Alcoholism, and every time I hear that or every time I read that, it's just me. That's just me. Countless vain attempts to drink like a normal person. I can't do that. You know, I'm insane when it comes to that stuff, you know, and it talks about, you know, one more vain attempt and one more failure. You know, that was me. And, you know, I went to rehab four times. The fourth rehab was a long-term one. I was in there for 7 months. And the thing that was different was I got told all the same stuff at all the rehabs I went to, but this time I was really desperate. And I'd come off a suicide attempt, and that's how I ended up in the rehab. I tried to hang myself, and it didn't work. And, I ended up in this rehab, and I got to the point where I had no other option. You know, I was scared. I didn't know what to do. Like the book says, I have a dilemma. You know, I have this dilemma. If I drink or I drug, I'm going to die. And if I don't drink and drug, I'm going to die. So I've got this dilemma and I don't know how to solve that problem. And, you know, I thought I was going crazy. I was broken, you know, and what happened in the second rehab, I got a phone number. And what happened, you know, it talks about having courage. So I got enough courage to ring this guy. And I rang him up and just said, look, I need your help. You know, and he told me to go to a meeting in St Kilda back home. And I met him there. And then he said to me, if you want what I've got, you've got to do what I did. And I didn't want to do that. I really didn't. You know, and anyway, so like, but I was desperate and I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do what you said. And so I had to start meeting him. The Deal Men's became my home group because it was his home group. And he just said, you know, you've got to do what I did. So I was meeting him an hour before every Sunday meeting. Our home group has a book study from 6 to 7, and then we have a like a guest speaker meeting like this for an hour from 7 to 8, and that's every Sunday, and then we also do it on Wednesday. So he was just like, I had to meet him an hour before those meetings and I'd read the book with him, and I'm like, how's this going to fix it? You know, like, what, well, I'm going to read a freaking book? You know, so I don't read books. So like, anyway, I he just showed me by reading the book, what the book really did for me and what he showed me was I knew I had a drug and drinking problem. I knew I was probably an alcoholic, but I didn't know what alcoholism was. I had no idea. And what the book does, it sets out really well. It explains, in the doctor's opinion, what we're like. You know, it explains the allergy and the middle obsession. You know, so what he did for me, he just showed me what he'd been shown. And that gave me a solution, you know, to a problem that I can't solve on my own, you know. And I didn't know how to do this, right? So he explained really well by going through the book, you know, paragraph by paragraph, sentence by sentence. And I asked a lot of questions, you know, and I really tried to wriggle out of this. I was trying to find the way out. How am I going to, you know, like, there's a chapter called How It Works. It's not called How to Work It Out. And I was trying to work it out. So anyway, he really explained it to me, you know, and, you know, there's a chapter, there is a solution that gave me hope, you know, Bill's story. I can remember the first time I read Bill's story, I rang my mentor, who's my sponsor. And I rang him up and said, dude, this has got nothing to do with me. This is about a stockbroker in New York in the 20s. And I work on construction sites in Melbourne. This is like, you know, and he didn't very say very much. He just said, stop trying to work it out and just fucking do it, and hung up. And I was not happy. How dare you hang up on the great Steve Apps? But anyway, so what actually happened was, he showed me what to do, and I went through the steps, you know, and by going through the steps, like it says in 12, I had this spiritual awakening, you know. But when we got to step 3, he started talking about the God, and I told him, I said, I don't do God. And he said, well, I don't want to really keep swearing, but like, he said, you're going to freaking die. And I didn't want to hear that. You know, and what he taught me was I'm an alcoholic. And he just said to me these things. I think it's like an AA trick that we all do when we sponsor. He said, do you believe I believe? And I believed. I believed he believed because he was banging on about God all the time and I didn't want to hear it, but he was talking about it. So I knew he believed. So I just made that. I just went with that. What happened with me, my home group became my higher power. For the first 2 years, it was just that bunch of guys. 80 guys on a Sunday night, you know, and that was my higher power. So I just ran with that, and I went through the steps, and by going through the steps, I found out what alcoholism is. I found out how to recover, and I just kept doing that. And that's all I've done. Like the guy who's got 20 years or whatever, 19 years, he said a day at a time. The book actually says that. It says I get a daily reprieve, contingent upon, which means I've got to do some stuff. You know, and being an alcoholic, I'm trying to work out what's the easiest way to do this. And like what my mentor, who's a very smart man, he said to me again, he goes, look, Steve, I've been around for a while, and this guy's 38 years sober, and he, or 37 years sober, and he said to me, trust me, if there's an easier, softer way, I would have found it by now. Like, so you don't have to look. I'm just telling you, you don't have to look. So what did I do? I looked. And there is no door number 3. There's only 2 doors, you know. It's go on to the bitter end, blocking out the past, and I'm going to die, I'm going to go to jail, or I'm going to go insane, you know. Or happy, joyous and free, which sounds like a really easy decision to make, but I didn't want to do that, you know. So, but what happened to me, I just did what I was shown, and my life got better, you know. And where am I now? I'm in a park in LA County in America. And how did that happen? Because no one was going to, you know, like, every single thing I have in my life at the moment, everything, I mean, my job, my the car I drive, like the relationship with my family, the relationship with my daughter, the relationship with my ex, like my boss, everything, every single thing, my house, everything I have or own, I've only got because of AA. because at the end I had nothing, you know, and I was done. And so I owe my life to AA, and I pretty much owe everything else to AA. And if you're new, if I can get sober, anyone else can do it. Because, you know, I was a liar, a thief, a cheat, a con man. I owed a lot of money. I had no friends at the end. I had two people talking to me, my mum and my three-year-old daughter. That was it, you know. But what this program gave to me, it didn't give me my old life back. I got a brand new one, you know, and it's awesome. It's really cool. Like, I'm standing in America. Like, holy shit. Like, and, you know, that's only because guys like Ruben, who you're going to hear next, you know. And, you know, if you're new, give it a crack. It works. It really does. Like, I wouldn't be standing here. I'd be dead. You know, I nearly died already a couple of times, and I'm not going to go back to that ever, you know. Yeah, I'll leave it there. yeah, Ruben. Our guest speaker is Ruben from Dog on the Roof. We good to go?
Yep.
Alcoholic, my name is Ruben.
Hi, Ruben.
The most important thing I can share is I've been clean and sober since April the 2nd, 1985. For that, I'm grateful. Thank you, Les, for inviting me. The Steves from Australia for joining me here today. That's a long journey, the path that we've done, that intersected to where we're at right now. I love this meeting. It is the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous lives strong in this meeting. It's really refreshing to go to somewhere where, even where they say hello and they welcome you, that word welcome is a pretty powerful word. It wasn't a word I heard a lot when I was new. People usually said, "I thought I told you never to come back," you know, and that was like an hour ago, and here you are again. And not everywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous is as welcoming as this. One time we literally, you know where Chico is?
Yeah.
Northern California. We literally drove like 10 hours to go to a meeting in Chico. And we walked in and it was like a scene from the old Westerns. Like, there literally was somebody playing a piano and everybody else was playing cards. We walked in and the guy stopped playing the piano. And everybody turned around and they looked at us. There was like four of us there. They sized us up and down and realized we weren't there to, you know, kill everybody, I guess. And they all just turned back around and doing what they're doing. They ignored us. And so when somebody says welcome, or they stick their hand out, or you cook, it really is a special thing. So I don't take that for granted. I thank you for that. So I was taught to share a little bit of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And welcome the newcomers. I'm a slipper myself. I understand that. But I know when you don't want to get sober, there's nothing anybody can do to help you. And when you do want to get sober, there's not much they have to do. Right? That's my story. And I know once you come to rehab or you start going in the fellowship. By the way, I was thinking about this the other day. I have a friend. He's that guy in the Big Book that talks about, saw that he was going to have a problem with drinking, and he didn't drink for 20 years until he retired. And then when he retired, within like 3 years, he was almost dead. A friend of mine literally is like that, and he's got 3 years sober now. When he was in rehab for the first time, everybody talked to him like he'd been a slipper for the last 45 years. And he had no idea what anybody was talking about, right? He had no clue what alcoholism was. He had no clue about what they were referring to. So I have to remember that there's people that might be here tonight that don't understand the disease of alcoholism, right? And so people put a lot of words into why they started drinking and the reasons, you know, I was born in the wrong century, I was the wrong color, my skin was too tight, it was too loose, you know, I wasn't born with the owner's manual, the wrong century, the wrong family, whatever the excuses are, you know, I felt less than, better than, insecure. All that stuff. All I know, I was about 5 or 6 years old. I grew up on the west side of LA, Santa Monica, Venice area. It was a birthday party. They had two punch bowls. They had the kiddie punch bowl and they had the adult punch bowl, right? And the adult punch bowl looked a lot more fun than the kiddie punch bowl. And I remember going and taking a drink out of the adult punch bowl, which was punch and spinata wine. And I took a drink of that and it went boom, right? And I believe at that moment an alcoholic was born. I loved the effect that alcohol gave me. And in hindsight is that I've always been obsessed with alcohol. I don't know what it's like to have a social drink. Every drink I ever took was for one reason and one reason only, and that was to get drunk. Now, I'm not telling you I was drunk from the time I was 5 until I came to A, but every chance I got, I snuck or stole a drink, which meant I was always irritable, restless, and discontent. When I first read that, I knew exactly what it meant. And people were always trying to fix that in me. They didn't understand why I was so grumpy. I just need another drink, you know? And so every chance I got, I snuck or stole a drink. I remember my first communion, they had that goblet of wine, and I reached up with my two little hands and I grabbed it, and I'm trying to suck down as much wine as I could, and the priest is literally like pulling the wine thing away from me. And then I go sit down, I'm trying to see if I caught a buzz, and then I felt guilty for trying to get drunk on the blood of Christ, and it wasn't a good thing. So in and out, in trouble, budding alcoholic. Nothing was ever my fault. It's everybody else's fault. When I started getting loaded the way I wanted to get loaded, I just entered junior high school. I found sex, drugs, and punk rock all in the same night. It was the early 80s, and my life turned 180 degrees. And from that point forward, that's all. I was just obsessed with drinking and using. And I started running away a lot. Now, as a father, having raised a few kids, I don't know what it's like not to know where your 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old kid is for days, weeks, or months at a time. I have no clue. But that's what my family had to deal with. And when I was drinking, I would have told you that I was breaking away from an oppressive environment. They were trying to control and mold me. They were jealous of my rock and roll lifestyle, you know, and they wanted to kill my creative spirit. And the truth was, I just went wherever alcohol took me. And so, when the wheels came off, I'd call home. I'd beg my way back in. I'd do the negotiation thing, and I'd get back in. And it was minutes, hours, or days later, I'd be off on another run, right? And I remember... I came out of a blackout one time. I was 14, and I was in Norco. And I'd never been out of the west side of LA. I thought I was like in Oklahoma. And right? And I was out there for 3 months, man. And then I just called my family, and I said, I'm sorry. Can I come home? You know I did wrong, and I did the negotiation stuff, and they came and picked me up. As long as alcohol was working, I could believe the lie of the way that I was living. Because there was always like moments of truth coming in there. And I had a sense that the way I was living and what I was doing was not the same as the people around me. I got arrested one night with 14 of us got arrested at one time. And we were in Long Beach, did that little elevator ride up there and the whole thing. And I woke up in the morning and I was the only one still in jail, you know. And everybody else's family came and got him. I was arrested at the age of 15, and we caused a 5-car collision. I wasn't driving, but we were in the car. Broke a little 5-year-old girl's back, and I got out and started breaking bottles instinctively. They took me to the hospital. I had a concussion, split chin, and they were like, something's wrong. You're 15, and nobody wants you, you know. And I wasn't an emancipated minor yet, but I was close to it. By then, my family was just tired. Like, my dad was tired, you know. My dad didn't want to believe one more time that this time it was going to be different. It was going to break him, you know. And so, like, those moments of truth that would, like, pierce the lie that I was living. But as long as I was getting loaded, I didn't care about the consequences, you know. I did not care about the consequences. I went to a party in a garage in June, and, like, I blinked, and I came to, and it was December. And I'm still in the garage, and I'm the only one left in the garage. It's me and a couple of weenie dogs, right? And they got cancerous tumors on their belly,
and everything's wet and it's soaked, and it's Christmas morning, and I wake up and I'm sick and I'm hungover and I'm by myself, and there's something that says this is wrong. You know, somewhere close by is your family. They don't know where you're at. There's a hole. There's something missing for them on Christmas morning. And instinctively, I knew that's not the way I was supposed to be, right? Somewhere within a few minutes, I got a hold of something. And as it started working, that guilt and shame changed to, I hope they suffer. I hope they learn their lesson this time, right? I hope they have a horrible Christmas. And that's what the lie of the disease started doing. It went from that party to this thing. And again, I didn't know what that was. I couldn't put a word to it. But it wasn't the same way everybody else was partying. You know, they were just having like a high school party, and I'm trying to get a job done. And that last time when I got arrested, I was given three choices. One was to go into the psych unit. I'd been in a psych unit before, a couple of them. They actually kicked me out of a psych unit for disrupting the therapeutic community. The guy said, there's something wrong with you, but it's not the same wrong that these other people have. I was trying to organize my fellow patients and to riot and all this stuff. And I got them going, and they were like, you got to go. They sent me home in a taxi, and I showed up at my parents' house, and they're like, you know, and anyways. And I don't like being locked up. I know there's people that love being locked up. I'm like a caged animal, man. I come out screaming. And I didn't want to go into juvenile hall. And they said, well, you can go to this drug rehab. And it was a lesser of three evils. It was a Monday. And I said, I can't go. Can I come in on Saturday? I got tickets to go see Black Flag on Friday. And they were like, the counselor will take you on Friday. And as they walked in and they locked the doors behind me, I realized that they maybe had lied to me. It was a lockdown facility. I got loaded twice while I was in that lockdown facility. It's not easy, but if you want to, you can, you know. And if you're getting loaded when you're in rehab or detox, there's a good indication that you just might have a problem, right? Because that's not in the party brochure, right? Take a bunch. Speed used to come in pill form, Benzedrine, Crosstops. If you take a handful of Benzedrine and you try to sit in group as people are opening up and sharing their feelings, and you're like laughing your ass off, and you're trying to act like nothing's wrong, it's like that's not a party, right? And but that's the way I was partying in the end. And once you know, you can never unknow, right? Once you know the truth of who and what you are, and somebody puts words to what you've been feeling and what you've been thinking and what you're living, even though the alcoholic ego wants to like debate and argue it, it just pierces through. And I remember somebody saying, we're not going to guarantee that you've had your last drink, but we're going to guarantee you'll never enjoy another one. And it was a fact. And my life changed upside down once I got out of that rehab. I was going to three or four meetings a week, and I was getting loaded all the time. I was going to meetings and arguing with people who are staying sober about what it is that they're doing wrong in their sobriety, right? And there was a lot of people on the West Side that would engage in those conversations with me, which is insane to be arguing with somebody that's loaded about what you're doing to stay sober. On the flip side, I would go to places where everybody's getting loaded, and I would try to stay sober, which is just as insane. And I hear people say, you know, it doesn't bother me anymore. I get grateful. I don't have to live like that. You know, I see the people. It's not that, and the degrading things. I don't see any of that. Everything just grays out, and the spotlight just comes on the one that it's working for. The guy or the gal that's drinking something, and you can see the weight of the world falling off their shoulders. Again, that little smile. The lights are coming on. You know, that's all I see is the magic of alcohol. And I would give anything to do that. Even though I know it's going to happen. That last year and a half, I never took a drink or anything where I believed that it was going to do anything but what it would have been doing for a long time. Creating chaos, not working. It wasn't fixing anything, but I could not be able to stop it. I didn't understand alcoholism. What I do know is that when I ended up in my last rehab, I was 12 days sober. Everybody hated me in that detox. I was cynical, like you've heard here tonight, you know, cynical about Alcoholics Anonymous, cynical about sponsorship. I never worked the steps. I never had a sponsor. I never did A like the same way that I got loaded. And at 12 days sober, some guy got up and said, if you want what we have. And I remember just thinking, I don't know what you have. I've never done what you've done, right? I have no clue what's going on. And at the coffee break, this guy came up, and I weighed 120 pounds at the time. I was like, I was pale white. I was a creature of the night. I was so pale, I was translucent. You know, you could see all my veins and vessels and all that stuff. And my nerves were shot from drinking and using and not eating. So I had this nervous twitch, you know, and I'm sitting in the meeting and I got this thing going on, and it felt like somebody was drilling a 3-inch hole from the top of my head down to the base of my spine. All the bones in my back felt hollow, brittle, like they're going to snap at any moment. My skin's crawling. My legs are pumping like a couple pistons. My head's like a blender just whirling. I'd be talking to somebody and I'd have like 8 conversations going on. Just like little pieces would just jump out. And every time I'd lay down, the acid would go up into my throat. And I'm sitting in that meeting, and I don't understand, you know. I was sleepy reasonable, even though I didn't know it. In fact, when I went into that rehab, I was talking to a nurse, and she said, I want to put you in this place. And I said, I don't want to go there. The reason I didn't want to go there, because they were like, I heard they had rules, like you had to get a sponsor, you know, and that you couldn't use the phone for the first 30 days. They said, People are going to sleep easy knowing you're in here. Like, they don't need to hear you on day 3 how much your life's changed, right? And how you've got it this time. Like, they would say that kind of stuff, right? And I was arguing with this non-alcoholic nurse about where I wanted to go. And she said, I thought you said you wanted to get sober. Very calm. And it was like she took this pin and just popped this balloon. When she said that, it was like, I just went, okay. Right? The fight was gone the way she said it. I believe that was God working a miracle in my life. If I wasn't in that rehab, sitting in that meeting at 12 days sober, back there, 2 nose rings, sides of my head shaved, hair's purple, and people are looking at me and they're laughing. One guy out of 300 in this big speaker meeting came up and he stuck his hand out to me and he said, are you new, right? And I said, yeah. I didn't qualify it. No, I've been around, you know. I just, yeah. And he said, why are you here? And I remember, like, trying to find the right answer, the one that's going to get you to shut up and leave me alone the fastest. I don't want to give you the wrong answer where you get that look like, aha, I got you, you know. So I'm going to tell you why you shouldn't think, act, or feel that way, and I'm going to give you a lecture. And I remember the only thing that could come out of my mouth when I was talking to this guy, the only answer I had, I said, I think I want to get sober. Now, a lot of places, the word think would be good for a good discussion, but he understood alcoholism. You know, he understood that I had that alcoholic dilemma. And what I found out the alcoholic dilemma is, you have valid answers to the same question and they're the opposite ends of the spectrum. If I don't stop drinking, I'm gonna die. If I don't drink again, I'm gonna die. Like, how can I wanna do the thing, sit in the meeting in another detox, and everything inside me wants to get drunk, but yet everything inside me wants to stay sober at the exact same time. I was sober a few years, and I heard Clarence Snyder, one of the founding members of AA in Cleveland, I heard his story, and he talked about that he's sitting, waiting for Dr. Bob to come in and talk to him, and he's looking up on the shelf, and there's a bottle of rubbing alcohol, and he's looking around in the doctor's office trying to see if there's anything in there that he can distill the alcohol down enough that he can drink it without killing himself. And the nurse walks in and she's got some pills. And he said, what's that? She said, these are pills that'll take the edge off. And he said, he got angry and started arguing with the nurse. She says, don't you understand? I'm here to get sober. And the first thing you want to do is give me drugs. And at that exact same time, he was trying to figure out how to drink the rubbing alcohol. He said, that's the alcoholic dilemma, right? I'm not one of these newcomers that came in here. Like, in fact, I never quit. I didn't wake up on April the 2nd, 1985 and said, today is the last day I'm ever going to drink, right? I was just going into another rehab. I was just trying to get well. I had surrendered that no matter what I did, no matter what I was going to do, I was always going to get loaded again. My son, when he got off the baby bottle, we had a bye-bye ceremony for his baba, right? So we had this whole ceremony where he got to throw away his bottle and say goodbye to it. Bye-bye, baba. And he cried and he went to the sippy cup, right? I never had a ceremony for my bye-bye to my baba, right? I never graduated a sippy cup, right? So when I told that guy, I think I want to get sober, he just smiled, you know, and he said, that's great. He said, if you want to stay sober, I will show you, because talk's cheap. He said, watch me. My actions are going to speak louder than my words. I liked that then. I love it today. He openly invited me to judge him. Watch my actions. Watch where my feet are going. And I don't know why I asked him to be my sponsor. I didn't know how long he was sober, right? I didn't know where his home group was. I didn't have like a questionnaire to interview him to see if he qualified to be my sponsor. I never had a sponsor. I didn't even know what a sponsor was. I had heard all these stories, like extremes, like a sponsor was either like this hard ass that was just like there to put their knee in the back of your neck, right? Or on the other side, like they were like these sweet little angels, you know? Like I heard this lady talking about, my sponsor said I shouldn't do this and that it wasn't the right thing to do. And I said, no, I'm going to do it anyways. And it was like I jumped off this cliff and I'm falling and I'm falling and I'm falling and I'm, no, I'm going to die. And there she was. She gently caught me, lowered me down, dusted me off, gave me a hug and said, I love you. You truly are special. And one day the rest of the world will realize how special you are and they will feel sorry for mistreating you. Those are the extremes of what I heard of what a sponsor was. I never heard anybody say, watch me. My actions are going to speak louder than my words. What I learned from that is we only share our experience, our strength, and our hope. Right? When I was that little drug addict, alcoholic, and I was arguing with people, I was arguing with people that were totally misinformed. You see, I only share with you my experience. These are the actions that I've taken, and here's the result. There's nothing to debate. I'm not telling you this is what you need to do. I'm not saying this is what you should do. I just say this is what I did, and here's the results. Can't argue, debate. You can say it's wrong, but I'm sober 39 years, you know, and I've been doing it wrong for 39 years, right? Something I absolutely believe that I couldn't do. And, at 42 days sober, I got kicked out of that rehab. They didn't like my attitude. And sometimes when you're rehab, they do those goodbye ceremonies, you know, the coin out thing, and everybody tells you how much they love you and how much you've grown. You should become a counselor and how wonderful you are. People are like, I hate you. I'm glad you're living. Leaving, you know, my counselor gave me a relapse packet, and he said, you'll be loaded within 90 days, and the rest of your life you're going to be in now some kind of institution. And that was my goodbye kiss from my counselor. He was absolutely 100% right. Left to my own devices and my own thinking, I should be loaded right now. What he didn't know, what I didn't know, was that man I had asked to be my sponsor was waiting for me. I called him up and I said, man, I just got kicked out of the rehab. I don't know what to do. He said, that's great. We're going on a camp out. You want to go on a camp out? And I'm like, I didn't have any pressing social engagements, right? I didn't have this feeling then or today that my once-in-a-lifetime chance is going to come shooting down that street over there and I'm not standing on the street corner, I'm going to miss out. Being an AA meeting has always been a step up since April the 2nd, 1985. It's never been a step down. Whatever I had out there is still there. It's just worse today. And it's like an old pair of running shoes I can walk in. So anything I was doing was just postponing the inevitable is the feeling that I had. And so I said, yeah, I'll go on this camp out. No idea what it was. And like 2 hours into this 4-hour drive to the desert, I thought I made a mistake. I don't like this guy. I don't like the way he talks. I don't like the way he walks. I don't like the cigarettes he smokes. I don't like the music he listens to. I don't like the fact all he wants to do is talk about AA, you know. And I get out to this desert, and I'm like 16 years old. And like I said, I was pale white. And there's like 70 grown-ass men in this desert. And like within 15 minutes, I'm cherry tomato sunburnt red. And I'm pissed, right? I'm pissed. And when I'm pissed, the whole world needs to be pissed, right? If I'm miserable, the whole world needs to be miserable. And they had a meeting that night. there's a bonfire and everybody's sitting around talking. And all I can think about was, if I stand up and I walk into the fire, I will ruin their camp out and they're going to take me home. I wasn't thinking about suicide, right? I was just thinking about take me home. I couldn't put the words. So after the meeting, everybody's sitting around, they're talking, they're laughing, they're doing stuff. And I walked up to this guy who was my sponsor. I already said I don't know what a sponsor is, right? But I'm standing behind him, kind of vibing out to him. Take me home, this sucks, I don't want to be here, blah, blah. I just wanted to get loaded, right? And he looked at me, he goes, what's wrong with you? Because you're creeping me out, lurching over my shoulder like that. He said, what do you want? And I was pissed. He's my sponsor, he's supposed to know, right? I've just been telling him, right? And I ran off into the desert. I grabbed a flashlight, a book, big book, and a lawn chair. And I rolled up like a roly-poly in the lawn chair because I'd seen like scorpions during the day. And after about an hour, I realized that nobody missed me. Everybody was still back at camp and they're all laughing and their fires. And it was like, nobody rang this bell like, we've lost our newcomer, right? Everybody spread out arm to arm and let's, you know, comb the desert. Go find the new guy. So I snuck back into camp, right? And when I snuck back into camp, I went to the sound of laughter when I went to bed. And when I woke up in the morning, I woke up to the sound of laughter. And when I woke up, I went to the source of that laughter. And there was an old zoot suiter. I found out he was an old zoot suiter from East LA. He was white Russian by birth, but he grew up there. And he was wearing a pair of bib overalls, no t-shirt, no fedora, and smoking a cigar. And he was talking about stories of going down to the pike and fighting with the Navy guys, you know, and going to the Oki bars in downtown LA and talking Spanish so that he could get in these fights. And he was just telling his story. And somewhere in that, him telling that story, I identified with the things he was talking about. He was answering questions that I had that I couldn't ask, putting words to feelings. And somewhere there, went from an old zoot suiter talking to this young punk kid, just one alcoholic talking to another. And he looked at me and he said, what's wrong? Many times before he passed, he would ask me that same question, what's wrong? And it wasn't like, what's wrong? Like, why do you look like that, right? And I told him the story about what happened the night before. You know, and he stood up in that chair of his and he had a little tear. And he looked at me and he said, you know, that's the first miracle of your sobriety. God put you somewhere where you couldn't run. He said, you're a runner your whole life. Every time you've hit a wall of fear, you ran. He put you somewhere where you couldn't run. And the other side of that wall of fear is always the good. Right? And I believe that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just one drunken bum talking to another the language of the heart. He said, if you stay in A, you're going to be okay. He didn't promise me the world. He didn't promise me anything else. And that was enough. Right? And what that meant was, if you stay in A, was I had to do the work. But there was a lot of things that those guys taught me about that, what that worked. You'll only ever hear two things in Alcoholics Anonymous. When it boils down to its most basic, you will only ever hear two things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You will hear people talk about, I know what the problem is. I can explain to you what the problem is, but I'm going to tell you why I can't or why I won't do it. And I'm going to tell you the bad results that I keep getting. And people say it with pride, right? Or you're going to hear people talk about, this is the problem. You heard Steve talk about it. Somebody presented me with the answer. I didn't have to understand it. I didn't have to believe it. I took the actions. And in spite of everything, it's worked out. I have worked the steps insincerely. I worked the steps with zero belief that it was going to work. Right? And I felt like a fraud doing it. But it was just what everybody else in my home group was doing. It wasn't like a special extra thing to do it. It was just what everybody happened to be doing. And it was just part of that formula. And in doing it, I had that spiritual awakening, right? And my spiritual awakening was, this works, right? I was sober 6 months, sit up at a meeting one night, and I was talking about all the things I didn't have. I don't know if the program's going to work. I don't know. Whatever. And this old-timer got me outside the meeting. He put his finger in my chest. He said, you little dumb shit. He goes, you're sober 6 months and you're talking about, you don't know if it's going to work. He said, you are sober 6 months. It's working. He said, stop talking about what you don't have and talk about what you do have. And that's 6 months of sobriety and the actions that you've taken. You don't have to talk about what you're going to get, and you don't have to talk about what you don't have or what you should have. Just talk about what you do have, right? And they helped me out with that kind of stuff. When I was new, how much time do I have?
More time.
A few minutes. When I was new, my sobriety meant more to you than it meant to me, right? And I'll give you an example. I'm a 10th grade dropout. I've never gone back to school. I have an amazing career, right? I've had an amazing life. But my first year and a half, I got fired from Orange Julius. I got fired from a gas station, and my job was to wash windows and help people pump the gas. And the guy said, I don't think you're cut out for this group. And I was just like one failure after another, right? And I spent like 8 hours trying to find a job when you used to have to like go knock on doors and ask them, are you hiring? And you had to fill out a piece of paper, and then you had to look somebody in the eye and have them tell you, you're a horrible human being. You have no experience, right? You have no skills. You have nothing to offer us. Why would we want to hire you, right? It wasn't like this anonymous thing. And I had spent 8 hours getting rejected. And I walked into the meeting that night with my shoulders down, felt like an absolute loser, an absolute failure. And I walked in, this old timer just lit up, and he said, you little crazy son of a bitch. He ran over and he grabbed me, he picked me up, and he trolled me around. He goes, when you left last night, I knew I would never, ever, ever see you again. He said, I really believe that you would be loaded right now. And I prayed for you. And he goes, you know what a miracle you are walking in that door? And that's what I mean. My sobriety meant more to you than it meant to me. And they reminded me how precious it was, right? They reminded me how precious it was. I went to go visit my mom when I was brand new, and I'll say two quick stories. And I knocked on the door. She opened the door. She didn't unlock the screen door. And she stared at me through the screen. Unlocked the door. Hand came out. Pulled me in. Sniffed me. Walked me into the living room. Away from the couch or the table. Stood me in the middle of the room. And looked me in the eye and started asking me questions. And I said, God damn, she's giving me a sobriety test. Right? And I went to the meeting that night and complained. I got 90 days, right? You know, there was a point in time that would have been a good reason to go get loaded, right? You don't appreciate my recovery? I'm going to show you. I'm going to take you back down memory lane, right? And I went, I was talking about that, and this old timer pulled me out afterwards. He goes, if half your story is true, if the hardest thing you ever have to do in your life is to allow that family who you tortured to look, see, smell, and feel your recovery, he said, let them do it as long as they want to, and be grateful that they can do that. Right? And they would help me put that in perspective, how to take my recovery home. Worked the steps, running out of time. My stepdad, he raised me. That guy that wouldn't go because he was going to get broken one more time. Father's Day 2020, middle of the pandemic, he had a stroke. We didn't see him for 6 weeks. Couldn't go see him. He was in rehab. The day he got out of the hospital, I went to go visit him at the house. And I was getting ready to leave. There's nobody in my family that resents my method of my recovery. There's nobody in my family that says, when are you going to stop going to AA? They're like, go. To this day, right? To this day, they know for a fact the only reason they have me is because of you. My mom, her crack, the thing that she loves the most is when I bring a newcomer to her house. She like cooks them like a 10-course meal like in 5 minutes. And she's just like, she knows they haven't eaten something in a long time like that, right? And she loves it because she knows without you, I wouldn't be. And when my dad got out of the hospital, I said, I got to go. I got a commitment going to meeting. My mom said, well, can you stay a little bit longer? I said, no. She said, okay. She understood, but, you know, she doesn't. Little Catholic mom guilt kind of thing. But she's okay, right? Go. She just has to say something, right? And I'm used to it. My dad grabbed me and he pulled me down. He could barely talk. And he said, A, good, go. And he pushed me away. Right? Can't buy that. Last December, well, almost a year ago, they gave him his last rites. And they said, you got to come see him at the hospital. He's not going to make it. He's still making it. Stubborn old man, right? I hate hospitals. I hate hospitals. I hate hospitals. I can't tell you how much I hate him. I walked in. He's got his back to me, and he's talking to the physical therapist. And she said, like, she gave me, like, a hold on, wait a second thing. And he's talking about my sister. What a great lady she is. And he's talking about my little brother. He's a baseball coach, star player, what he does. And then he said, and there's my middle son. Said he was lost, right? He was lost for a lot of years. But then he got sober and he found a purpose, right? I believe that's my God talking to me, you know, telling me I'm on the right path, right? And if all I have to do is come here, have some amazing tri-tip, pico de gallo, right? Hear your story about getting sober in the park, right? Wandering this thing. Have somebody smile that's seen me in the past, said, I'm glad to see you again. If that's selling out to Alcoholics Anonymous, I will take it, right? I will take it because I am overpaid, right? This is the hardest thing I have to do to get to live. To come here today with my two friends from Australia, I don't have time to tell you that story, right? I've been there 5 times. It's like, how do I go from that to this, to having the blessings that I have in my life? My life is not perfect by any means. It is not perfect by any means. But I get to walk on the sunny side of the street. You know, okay, I'll tell you one story and then I'll shut up. So there's this newcomer, right? And he's sitting in the morning meeting and he's complaining, man. I'm trying to get sober and I don't have a job. And I don't have any skills. I don't even have a car. If I just had a bicycle, I'd be all right. I could go find this thing, right? After the meeting, this old timer comes up, said, I'll let you borrow my bicycle if you promise you're not going to jackass around, do anything else but go look for work. I promise. The fair's starting this weekend, right? He's riding his bicycle around, happens to be going by the fairgrounds, and there, laying on the ground, is a ticket to go into the fair. You know, without even thinking, he gets down, picks up the ticket, runs into the fairgrounds. He's running around. After like half an hour, 45 minutes, he realizes he left the bicycle outside there, and he never locked it up. So as he's running from one end of the fairgrounds to the other, he starts doing that negotiation prayer with God. God, please let the bicycle be there. If the bicycle's there, I promise I'm going to show up to the meeting early. When they ask for volunteers to stay late, I'm going to be there, right? All the negotiation stuff that we do when we're in crisis. And when he gets out there, like, lo and behold, there's the bicycle. You know, the heavens open up. God answered his prayers. So he gets on his bicycle and he rides over to the Lano Club to the new meeting. And he runs in and he tells everybody his God story, right? Everybody's crying. They're all had a spiritual awakening. They're moved by his deep story. And after the meeting, he goes outside and the bicycle's gone. Right? The moral of the story is prayer may get you here, but prayer alone ain't going to keep you here. God's not going to come down and lock up that bicycle for you, right? God may have got you here, but it's up to you to do the work. It's up to you to get a sponsor. It's up to you to work the steps. It's up to you to go to meet. Up to you to show up, cook, clean, like what I've seen here tonight, right? And then God does. My sponsor says, God does 99% of the work. I got to do 1% of the work, but it takes 100% of me to do that 1%. He does the rest. Thank you. God bless.
We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
We think not.
Thank you. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Now, after a moment of silence for the alcoholic that still suffers in and out of these rooms and the innocent children caught in the crossfire, please join me in the Lord's Prayer. Knock, knock. Whose Father?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.
Keep coming back, Robert, you're working.